Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another Monday Memo from Concordia Seminary. Today we're going to talk about an event which is just 6 days away from today, next Sunday to be specific. And perhaps more important, we'll talk about an event that took place just 50 years ago, next Sunday, June 13th. And as you might guess, I'm referring to the 50th anniversary of the dedication of the Clayton campus of Concordia Seminary, for which we're making some rather interesting plans. First of all, I'd like to share some of these plans with the radio audience, and after that, it will be a real treat to hear firsthand from two people who were here for that great day 50 years ago. Let me share with you some of the plans which we have made for this observance next Sunday. There will be a carillon concert at 2:30 in the afternoon, with Dr. Raymond Kaldemans of Springfield, Illinois. At 3:30, we will have the highlight of the day, namely the worship service. The service will be held outdoors behind the log cabin, and those of you who've been there in the heat of summer know that it's always cool behind the log cabin. The service itself will be very similar to the original service. We will sing the same hymns. The choirs will sing the same selections. And speaking of choirs, there will be two mass choirs, one adult and one children's. Mr. Leland Johnson of Emmanuel Olivet will direct the adult choir, and Mr. Richard Giesecke of Concordia Maplewood will conduct the children's choir. The speaker and preacher at the service will be Dr. Paul Stoyford of Fairview Park, Ohio. Many of you in the St. Louis area may remember him as the former pastor of St. Matthew's Church here in St. Louis. One thing that I think will add a lot of color to the whole service is the first part of the service. There will be a large procession of flags of all the countries for which Concordia Seminary has prepared missionaries, and these will be carried by the laymen of area churches. Then also, as part of the service, there will be an academic convocation at which eight individuals will receive special honor and recognition. Then after the service, at 5:00, there will be a picnic supper, and that will be around the library fountain. Several other interesting items. Dr. C.F.W. Walter's carriage will be on display. And incidentally, that carriage was also on display 50 years ago. We hope to have some antique cars that were used in 1926. Notice I said hope to. At this point, we don't. The members of the Seminary Guild will be in costume of the 1920s, which ought to add some real flavor to the occasion. And also, they will have a lemonade stand. And believe it or not, you'll be able to buy lemonade for 5 cents a glass. Then in the evening, and this will be indoors in the chapel at 7:30, two rather unusual films will be shown. One of the original dedication 50 years ago. In this film, which of course is without sound, there will be individuals like Dr. Cooper, Dr. Fultonhauer, Dr. Bainton, and many others whom some of you may remember. The other film will be Call of the Cross, which, again, some of the old-timers in our audience may remember. This is a film which was produced in 1938 by our clinic and tells the story of hardship and heartache of our Saxon Lutheran immigrants who came to this country. This film was produced totally by local talent, and it really has a unique message. President Price will be there in the evening to introduce the film. So we hope that each one of you in our radio audience will be here. However, if that's not possible, it's interesting that the service will be broadcast over KFUO. Our main thrust throughout the day will be to try to relive the day of dedication 50 years ago. I became more and more interested in this whole thing as time went on, and I said earlier in the program that we had a real treat in store for you today. We have in our studio two people who were at that service 50 years ago on June 13th, 1926. We have, first of all, Mrs. Herbert Dorn and Mr. Mr. William Lahman. Mr. Lahman, you were living in St. Louis at that time, right?
That's right.
And Mrs. Thorne, you were not living here. Where did you come from?
I came from Fort Wayne, Indiana.
Fort Wayne, okay. When I started doing some research on what it was like on that day 50 years ago, I have to admit that the more I researched, the more interested I became in the whole thing. I have here, for instance, copies of the Post Dispatch and the Globe Democrat of the following day, and the headlines and accounts are most interesting. For instance, the one headline here says, New Concordia Seminary here is dedicated by Lutherans, and then underneath, ceremony witnessed by largest gathering of Lutherans ever assembled in the United States. Crowd estimated to exceed 50,000. Then in the Globe Democrat, this caption, $3 million Concordia Seminary dedicated before 75,000. And in other accounts that I read, they went as far as to say that they were close to 100,000. My first question, Mr. Lahman, is it true that there really were that many people?
Well, I didn't count them, but I know there were a mass of people around. Every place you looked, there were people either standing or moving around. So there could have been close to 50,000.
Mm-hmm. Would you venture, or could you tell us how far they extended from one end to the other? For instance, did it start all the way down at the Mun, or not quite?
I would say that by the time the service has actually begun, or a little thereafter, that the entire eastern boundary, the eastern portion of the grounds, mm-hmm. and the southern portion and the northern portion, were crowded to the extent of the seminary's property,
mm-hmm.
because actually, such a large group coming to one central place like the seminary grounds at that time, not everybody could come in directly. There were some delays in the traffic coming on the streets around
mm-hmm,
here.
Mm-hmm.
So naturally, there was delay and delay and delay.
Yeah. With that many people, first of all, how did they get here? Now, I think Mrs. Thorne will have a little bit to say about that from those who came from out of town, but how did the local people get here?
Well, from my observation, we didn't have too many automobiles those days, but almost every congregation in the greater St. Louis area and even farther beyond made up parties where people would come in with their cars and take additional congregational members with them into the service here.
Mm-hmm.
Because we didn't have any modern buses running as we have them today,
mm-hmm.
so it was a matter of having to make arrangements in most instances to get into St. Louis
mm-hmm.
on your own or somebody else's transportation.
Mm-hmm. So they probably were what we would call carpools.
That's right. That's what I was referring to, the equivalent
mm-hmm.
of carpools.
What about streetcars? Were there streetcars at that time?
Oh, sure, that's a streetcar.
They were rather slow, I guess, huh?
Well, no, but in 26, there was a pretty good streetcar system at that time.
Mm-hmm. Not many better than our bus system now. We won't comment on that.
I would say this, you could usually count on them with more regularity than you could with buses, because the streetcars had their own right-of-way,
mm-hmm.
and unless something broke down in the streetcar, on the streetcar track, the streetcars kept moving.
Mm-hmm.
If something did happen on the streetcar track, there was no additional tie-up of traffic. They removed it, and the streetcars went through again.
Yeah, that had a lot going for it, didn't it?
Yes, it did.
Well, I read somewhere that, first of all hotels in St. Louis were put under contract for space. All garages, all tourist camps, everything was reserved for this dedication. Do you remember anything of that? You probably were not involved with it.
Well, I wasn't directly involved, but through working with the ISIS group and several other groups around here, I know they were, it's far away as St. Charles people were staying at that time. Belleville and Collinsville and all those areas.
Mm-hmm.
People came into some of those central points and then came over here.
Mm-hmm. What kind of, and this is another thing that I read, that each congregation had its own committee to help with the arrangement. Is this how you got involved? I should mention, first of all, that I'm looking here right now at some pictures which Mr. Lahman gave me, and these are pictures of where he is riding a horse. And it says on the back that it's the dedication of Concordia Seminary. Now, surely you didn't ride many miles on horseback to get here. Well, tell us something about those pictures.
The extent of my riding on horse to get to the seminary was from the Mounted District stables in Forest Park, because as the ushers were making plans for the dedication, the question came up about the terrific amount of parking and directing that was necessary.
So I
knew Mr. Ellerman. I think he was with Bethlehem Church at the time.
Mm-hmm.
He was known as a man that had fine riding horses, so mm-hmm. I spoke to him about it and tried to make arrangements to use his horse, but
mm-hmm.
in turn it was thought best not to, because his horse was accustomed to just straight riding
mm-hmm.
and not being surrounded with automobiles and people and, you know, heavy traffic.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So he then put me in touch with the gentleman at the Mounted District headquarters in Forest Park, and he then finally loaned us a horse.
Oh, and
I rode from the Mounted. I parked the car down there. In fact, I didn't really have to park the car because my present wife lived at King's Highway on
mm-hmm.
Oakland,
mm-hmm.
and to keep one less car on the grounds here, where they
mm-hmm.
drove me over to the Mounted District, and then I mounted the horse and came out here to the seminary.
I see. And were you the only one then on horseback?
Yes. To my knowledge, I didn't see anybody else before.
Mrs. Thorne, do you remember seeing that horse or not?
No, I don't remember.
You don't see any people. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I imagine that gave you a real vantage point, didn't it, to be on horseback?
Well, yes. There was a sort of a layout of the seminary grounds prepared, which was used by the Ushers for
mm-hmm.
designating areas for certain people to take care of.
Mm-hmm.
And so that these Ushers were all placed at these very strategic points as noted on the blueprint.
Mm-hmm.
And in turn, by my being at least 5 feet higher than the rest
mm-hmm.
of the people
mm-hmm.
around, by being on the horse, by being on the back of the horse, when people would hold up their hand and mark one or two or three, something like that, well, I knew how many cars I could direct over in that direction so that they would be able to park.
Yeah, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, that's extremely interesting. We'll turn for a minute to you now, Mrs. Dorn. You were living in Fort Wayne, but you came here. May I ask what the special attraction was for you?
Well, we have a good group of author leaders in Fort Wayne, and we had a special train on the Wabash.
Oh, really?
And we left about 1 a.m. in the morning.
On Sunday?
On Sunday,
mm-hmm.
and tried to do some sleeping. We had about 8 cars, though.
8 cars?
8 cars.
All on this one train?
On this one train.
Oh, my.
And we brought lunch along.
Mm-hmm.
We arrived at the Union Station, and from the Union Station, they put us all on trolley cars, and they were open-air trolley cars.
We mm-hmm. were in St. Louis.
Here in St. Louis.
Oh.
And we rode on the trolley car to High Point.
High Point. That's McCausland.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And from High Point, we had to walk over here to the seminary cars, which we didn't mind. We
mm-hmm.
were young and full of fun, having a good time.
Yeah. Well, that is very interesting. Do you remember what time it was when you arrived here? If you started at 1 in the morning, how?
Well, it seemed like it was between 8 and 9 when we arrived.
In the morning?
In the morning.
Oh, I see. Uh-huh. And then you spent the afternoon here?
We spent the whole day right here on campus.
Uh-huh.
And then went back the same way to the Union Station on the
trolley. Uh-huh. How did you find your whole group? How did you stay together? Or wasn't this a problem? Or?
Well, we didn't. Many of us stayed together. We roamed around. We knew that we were supposed to be at High Point at a certain time.
Oh, I see. You all met there.
Yeah,
uh-huh.
We met there.
Yeah. You had kind of a special interest, though, too, in addition to your dedication, right, for coming here.
Well,
I think you were an engaged girl, weren't you?
Oh,
almost.
I say that.
Oh.
That was
that a bad word. You were not to be engaged as a student at that time. Is that right?
Well, no, you were not.
Yeah.
But he was also from Fort Wayne, and so
oh,
he was on the train with us.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. Now, were these mostly young people, or were they old?
They were mostly young people.
Mostly young people, huh? Now, this was not the only chartered train, I'm sure. Do you remember some of the other cities from which?
Yes, I remember. I had a very dear friend from Fort Dodge, Iowa, Paula Bertrand Phelan. Mm-hmm. And we were going to meet here in St. Louis, and we walked the whole day long but never met.
Oh, well, I can believe that, if there were 50 or 75,000 people. So you never did get to meet her.
Never got to see her, no.
Well, okay, another thing I'm wondering about that either one of you may remember, what did people do for food? Was something sold?
We brought lunch along.
You carried it here on the ground?
Yes, we had it in boxes and bags.
Did everybody do that?
I don't know what everybody did.
They made arrangements to have a little stand on the seminary grounds here.
Hot dogs,
they sold hot dogs.
Yeah.
And they also said, now I'm not sure if it was sort of pop all of the lemonade, but you could get refreshments also.
I see.
But legally, it was. I didn't think people on these stands to get up.
I would think so.
To be served.
Yeah, yeah.
But,
Now, I noticed also from the newspaper accounts that there were several other interesting things that happened. For instance, there was a reference to pickpockets. Do either of you remember anything about that?
No, I don't recall that.
Well, I was too far away from the real heavy crowds that I wouldn't really observe it or notice it.
Yeah, I guess that would be true. I don't have it available here immediately, but I remember that reading that there were some reports about pickpockets after the offering had been taken. And by the way, there were armored cars that came right after the offering was taken. And I was interested in the reference that an angry Lutheran turned one of these men over to the police, and that was the end of that incident. Then there's another reference to the Red Cross stations and saying that a lot of people fainted from the heat. Do you remember anything about that? Or do you remember that there were these Red Cross stations?
There was a record tent out here.
Oh,
it had the big Red Cross on the side of it.
Uh-huh.
And I'm pretty sure that was manned by the nurses from the Lutheran Hospital.
Oh, I see.
Dr. Hanser was active in Lutheran circles, and he was also very active out at the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And if I remember correctly, he volunteered to provide nurses and for first aid and that kind of thing out here, because it's such a large crowd, naturally, you had to be prepared if something happened.
Yeah. Were there seats provided for some of the group?
Yes, there were seats, but it seems like we were never lucky enough to find a seat.
I guess not.
Well, if I remember correctly, the old Walkie Soap Company had these wooden boxes those days. They weren't using cardboard like they're using today.
Yeah.
And they sent out a couple of trucks with these wooden boxes.
Oh, really?
And they just put planks over them from box to box to arrange for seating. Because you couldn't expect the people that were probably a little more rugged those days than they are today to stand for such a long time. They had a sit.
Yeah.
And there wasn't much grass around due to the activity of building here. So if you sat on, you'd be sitting on the desk.
I guess so. Were there more trees or fewer than we have now? Do you remember generally?
Fewer? It was very dusty and dirty.
No
matter which way you turned.
Uh-huh.
Well, I would imagine that if you are out here if you're out here next Sunday, and you look around, you can about tell which of the trees that were here.
I suppose.
When they were here.
Yeah.
But as I remember, that we did a lot of searching around and sort of stepping it off for parking cars in among all these trees. There were quite a lot of trees.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, where the buildings are now, they were all trees that had to be uprooted at the time when they put up the buildings.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How about the service itself? Was there anything in particular that impressed either one of you? How about the German address that was given by Dr. Fultonhauer? Did most people understand it? I guess there's no way you can really tell.
Not in our group, anyway.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. How about...
I would imagine there were a lot of people most days who could understand German,
mm-hmm.
most young people, because complete English service didn't start until maybe about 10 or 15 years prior to the dedication. This background and the foundation were all taught in the German language.
Mm-hmm.
And to go ahead and give you all more information, most church churches, instead of having Sunday school, we had Christian Lyric.
Yeah.
And that was a matter of pastor questioning the children in connection with Bible history and things.
And right in the service.
That's right, yes, right at the service, yes, ma'am.
Oh, I'm old enough to remember that, too. In the service itself, talking about the German element, the A Mighty Fortress was sung in German, as you noticed from the report, and also that this could be heard a mile and a half away. Isn't that interesting? That must have made quite an impression on
the
people.
Well, the sound here is sort of on a high level.
Yes, that's
and actually, with that larger crowd singing, it could be heard almost as far as you can hear the carillon bells today.
Yeah,
if you're
Mrs. Thorne, I think the women in the audience would be interested in hearing your observations about the dress styles, for instance. Was there anything in particular that didn't?
Yes, I was quite amused to see Fulton Hall, Steerbringer, and a few others in frock-tailed coats. And it was so warm that day, and they were walking down the lane, and I felt so sorry for them while they were wearing such heavy clothing.
I guess so. How about you yourself? Did you come with any kind of a special dress?
Well, of course, I thought it was special for the day, but I guess everybody had a special dress to wear that day.
And I understand that maybe this dress will be on display on Sunday, because you still have it.
Yes, I still have it.
Well, I think there'd be many people who'd be interested in seeing that. It would be even nicer if somebody could wear it, but if that's not possible. How about the umbrellas on these pictures? What were they for?
Well, that's what amused me very much, and I couldn't understand because there wasn't a cloud in the sky, but they said they were carrying them for the heat.
For the heat, yeah.
Get out and save.
Yeah, yeah. Was that normal? I guess the people did that.
Oh, in that area, 20 to 26 in Sioux area, like many people just out walking or so would carry umbrellas. Shield them from the sun.
I guess so. Well, what happened then after the service was over? Now, that started at 2:30 in the afternoon, and even if it lasted till, say, 4 o'clock, did the people just all go home then, or? Remember?
It seemed like we wandered around on the ground in the building.
I suppose, yeah.
A lot of people stayed around and moved around because they knew their friends were there, and they were out moving around trying to find their friends. But it was such a big crowd, if you found them, you were lucky.
Yes, uh-huh.
They didn't have public address systems like they have today.
No.
Go to somebody and make an announcement and raise the meter at a certain specified spot.
How about the choirs that sang? That must have been very impressive. Over 1,000 voices from mass choirs. How could they get so many people together?
Well, I don't know, but in those days when events such as this took place, there was terrific cooperation between the lay people and the lay women to participate in these endeavors. And I know I'll remember forever, I guess, the hearing the mass voices, I mean the mass singing of this terrific crowd, even though I was not immediately among them. But you could hear every word that they were singing.
Is that right? Yeah.
It's quite an inspiration.
Well, we don't have much time left, but I'm wondering if either one of you would like to share what impressed you the most about the whole thing 50 years ago.
The beautiful building.
And as I understand it, I think all of Lutheranism really looked forward to seeing this campus completed. Is that fair? That's correct. Mr. Lyman, how about you?
Well, I was in and out of the old seminary on South Jefferson many a time because a very dear friend of mine, Ed Bantow, later of Detroit, he was attending the seminary at the time. And we also went down there for basketball practice and things, so we were in and out of the seminary, and which was quite a well-built building. But to see this new campus and the new buildings was very impressive, and everybody, I think, was just longing to get out here.
I guess so. Well, I see that our time is up.
Thank you so much, both of you, Mrs. Herbert Dorn and Mr. William Lauman, for being with us today. You really made me feel like I was there myself. Thanks again.
Yeah, it was a pleasure to be here.
Good afternoon, and welcome to another Monday Memos from Concordia Seminary. This is the weekend when our nation is observing its 200th birthday. Yesterday, we heard church bells ringing throughout the length and breadth of our city and all over the country, all calling attention to the freedom which our country gained 200 years ago when the Declaration of Independence was signed on July 4, 1776. But what does all this have to do with Concordia Seminary or with the Lutheran Church? To be sure, as you and our radio audience know, neither the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod nor Concordia Seminary were in existence in 1776. But what we'd like to talk about today in connection with our nation's bicentennial is how the Lutherans got to this country and how they felt about the Revolutionary War. We're fortunate to have in our studio today an individual whose field of specialization is church history and who probably knows more about Lutheran people and the impact they have had on the various events in history than anyone else in the Missouri Synod. Also, our guest today is chairman of our Synod's Bicentennial Committee and has therefore worked very extensively with the various bicentennial activities in our church. He is an adjunct professor of church history here at the seminary, and he serves on the Black Centennial Committee and is secretary of the Synodical Task Force on Structure. Actually, I think we could spend some time talking about each one of these committees, but today we're going to limit ourselves to the bicentennial. Normally, I know the guests who appear on this program only casually. Today, however, I would venture to say that I know our guest perhaps better than anyone else in the world does, since he is my husband, Dr. August Chilflo, Director of Concordia Historical Institute. August, could you first of all tell us something about the Synodical Bicentennial Committee? Who are the members of that committee? How often do you meet? Is your work continuing, or has it been completed by now?
Yeah, that's at least three different questions. It's an interrogation of some sort.
Okay.
The Bicentennial Committee of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod has been functioning for several years. It was created by the New Orleans Convention, and the members serving on the committee constitute a very versatile group. There's Donald Carpenter from St. Louis. He's a brother of the treasurer of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, Dr. Milton Carpenter, and Mrs. Esther Stalke from the faculty of Concordia Theological Seminary in Springfield. Mrs. Stalke is secretary of the committee, and Mr. Carpenter is vice chairman. In addition to that, we also have Dr. Richard Bardolph. Governor Otis Bowen of Indiana is a member of our committee, and President Hughley of Valparaiso University, Major General Gerhard Hyatt from Washington, D.C., former Chief of Chaplains, Mr. Tom McDougall from North Dakota, and Dr. Louis Spitz, Jr. from California, and the Reverend Cyril Wismar of Marblehead, Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. These people constitute our Bicentennial Committee.
Well, is the work of this committee for the most part finished, or?
Yes, to a very great degree it is completed. We have one more meeting scheduled for mid-July this month to wind up the affairs, to see whether we ought to have some additional bicentennial buttons produced and decals made. The first run was exhausted very early because of the great deal of interest that was expressed in them.
Mm-hmm.
I have a copy here of our bicentennial button, which shows the logo or the symbol that we had adopted. By the way, Chaplain Vensky was the artist who drew up the design for the logo.
Mm-hmm.
And very interestingly, I think leads us perhaps into some historical questions that you might want to ask. The logo has as its theme
life and liberty through Christ,
mm-hmm.
which is another emphasis on the fact that we Lutherans want to emphasize the fact that it is the gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ that frees us and that gives us this new life and liberty.
Mm-hmm.
The sailing vessel, which is really the symbol of all Lutherans who came over to this country, beginning even in the early 1600s, and on the sails is superimposed the crest or the coat of arms that Martin Luther designed for himself,
mm-hmm.
to symbolize the Lutheran aspect of the bicentennial observance. And then the sailing vessel sails on a furled flag of our country.
Mm-hmm.
So it is very colorful. I think it's very symbolic. And I think it relates well what we were trying to do as a bicentennial mm-hmm. committee.
Are any more of these buttons available to people who do request them, or is the supply totally exhausted?
Right now the supply is totally exhausted, and that's also true of the decals, which were very beautifully done in the same medium.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a possibility that when our committee meets in mid-July that we may decide to have some new ones manufactured.
Okay. Well, what precisely did your committee do? Certainly you did more than designing these buttons.
Yes, one of the biggest contributions I think that we made was a little pamphlet entitled Bicentennial Worship Materials. Our committee prepared this material and sent it to all the congregations of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod.
Oh, I see.
One of the very interesting facets of this booklet is the fact that it contains a 1748 worship order of service.
Hmm.
This was the one that had been designed by the patriarch of the Lutheran Church in America, the Heinrich Melchior Muhlenberg in Philadelphia. So that it gives our worshipers today an opportunity to tie up historically with a kind of worship that was carried on in America even many decades before the Revolutionary War. And it's amazing how similar that is to our own worship service today, either with or without Holy Communion.
Mm-hmm.
Then there is a collection of prayers, litanies, and various other elements, collects, that people may select for congregational use and put them together in various ways. There's a liturgy of life, liberty, and the pursuit of God's kingdom.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a collection of all kinds of worship materials and resources, even some hymns that were prepared particularly for the bicentennial worship.
Do you expect that people will continue to use that throughout the coming year, or is most of it over by now?
No, we're suggesting that not only on July 4th, but also on Reformation Day, All Saints Day on November 1st, and a Day of National Thanksgiving on November 25th.
Okay.
Those are four suggested dates when they can use this material. And in addition, we have also suggested that they use the chronology which appears in the Lutheran Annual, which gives them all kinds of additional suggestions of dates when this may be used. For example, on, I believe it's today's date, Gloria Dei Lutheran Church in Philadelphia was dedicated in 1700. Now that may be another event where they might want to use some of the material.
Mm-hmm.
If any in our radio audience would like to get a copy of this booklet, what would they do?
They can write to Concordia Historical Institute for a copy. There are a few left.
Okay.
And order the Bicentennial Worship Resources or Materials.
Okay. Is there a charge for
there
the
is, there is a nominal charge of $1 plus 25 cents postage and handling.
I see. Uh-huh. Okay, I guess that kind of covers the work of the Bicentennial Committee. In talking about the nation's bicentennial in our church circles, The one question I've noticed that invariably comes up is, were there any Lutherans in the United States at the time of the Revolution? And if so, how did they get here? Can you tell us something about that?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, because you have mentioned earlier already that Nida Concordia Seminary, which was organized in 1839, nor the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, founded in 1847, were in existence in 1776.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose facetiously one could ask how our country could manage for all those years before having these two very fine institutions established.
That's true.
But really, they are not too tardy when you really begin to think of it. The Missouri Synod established some perhaps 75 years after the Declaration of Independence, and Concordia Seminary only some 60 plus years after the Declaration. Now, where did the Lutherans come from? I have a book that I brought along, which I thought was one of the most interesting books, I think, on Lutheran participation in American history that I have ever read. It's entitled The Way to Hudson Bay,
mm-hmm.
and the subtitle is The Life and Times of Dense Monk. It was produced by Torkild Hansen, who is a Norwegian newspaper reporter. It was translated into English and published by Hartford, Brace and World in New York, and published in 1965.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this book is based very extensively on a ship's log which Jens Munk, a Danish sea captain, kept of his ill-fated expedition to the Spices of India in 1619 and 1620.
Mm-hmm.
Now that takes us back to some of the earliest dates of Lutheran activity in North America.
Mm-hmm.
This Danish expedition, consisting of two ships and 60 plus sailors, had its winter quarters in the Hudson Bay area of Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And the description that we have of that gives us also the first description of a Lutheran clergyman officiating in North America. His name was Rasmus Jensen.
Mm-hmm.
So that as far as our Lutherans are concerned, we can, to some degree, use the date of 1619, when the first Christmas Lutheran Christmas service with Holy Communion was observed up there in that very icy northern part of our country.
Mm-hmm.
The chaplain himself died of scurvy on February 20th, 1620, and is buried up there. So he's the first Lutheran clergyman to be buried in the North American continent.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there are other traces of Lutheran settlement in New York City, for example. This goes back to about 1611, so that precedes the Danish expedition in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
The first Lutherans came to Manhattan Island, first on record, came
mm-hmm.
to Manhattan Island about 1611. That New York Lutheran group is very fascinating, and I think this ties more directly up with where we are today in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod. These Lutherans organized a congregation in 1648.
Mm-hmm.
Known as the Church of the Unaltered Augsburg Confession, and that later became St. Matthew's Lutheran Church, which today is a member of the Missouri Synod.
Yeah, I was just going to ask that, whether this was the antecedent of that church.
Yeah, it's really the same church with a continuing history.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the other thing that's so interesting about this particular church is the fact that it received the first charter issued to any group for religious worship in America,
mm-hmm.
and this comes in 1664.
Mm-hmm.
Some of our American textbooks are not quite accurate when they talk about the granting of religious charter to groups, to congregations in America,
mm-hmm.
so that the Lutheran Church has quite a distinctive record here.
Mm-hmm. Was there anything more you were going to say about the Lutherans coming here?
Well, the first Lutherans also in New York were very severely persecuted. In fact, the first pastor who served this St. Matthew's Church in New York City was deported by the Dutch authorities. Peter Stuyvesant, governor of New Amsterdam, saw to the deportation. And so it is not until the arrival of the English, when the English took over New Amsterdam and made that New York, that this charter of religious worship and freedom was granted. Mm-hmm. And that's where we get the date of 1664 from.
Mm-hmm. Well, the other question that I've often wondered about, and I'm sure that people in our radio audience might have, is there any way of knowing how the Lutherans felt about the Revolutionary War? Were they in favor of it, against it, or neutral? Or don't we know?
Well, yes, we do know. The Lutherans, I think, very generally, took a very similar attitude that most other denominations took at the time. The Episcopal people, Anglican Church, found itself with various shades of tendencies and leanings. The Lutherans did too. There were others who had mixed feelings about the war or the prelude to war. Maybe one of the best ways to describe the general Lutheran attitude would be to look at the Muhlenberg family, the same patriarch that I referred to before.
Yeah.
He recorded in his diary, and I jotted down a couple of notes that he made, on July 4th, 1776, 200 years ago, he made this entry in his diary, and I think that's very significant. Today the Continental Congress openly declared the United Provinces of North America to be free and independent states. This has caused some thoughtful and far-seeing melancholics to be down in the mouth. On the other hand, it has caused some bloodthirsty, narrow-minded people to exult and to shout with joy. This remains as a comfort to believers. There is one who sits at the rudder, who has the plan of the whole before him, to whom all power in heaven and on earth is given, and who never yet made a mistake in his government. He it is who neither sleeps nor slumbers, and who has asked his people to pray, "Hallowed be thy name, thy kingdom come, thy will be done." Now that doesn't sound like a very ardent patriot who recorded that.
Certainly doesn't.
Muhlenberg felt rather strongly that the power, the government that is in existence, has been ordained by God.
Mm-hmm.
And since King George was a Hanoverian from the House of Hanover, Muhlenberg himself was of the House of Hanover, Muhlenberg really had two reasons why King George was his government, not only as the King of England, but also, if he reverted back to his German antecedents, King George III was his government in that case also.
Mm-hmm.
So for Father Muhlenberg, this became quite a problem.
Mm-hmm.
For his sons, however, who two particularly were very much involved in the war effort, and both of them, by the way, were Lutheran clergymen. For them, it was a totally different kind of a situation. Peter Gabriel Muhlenberg, who served a congregation in Woodstock, Virginia, at the outbreak of the Revolutionary War, one Sunday morning appeared in his black Geneva pulpit gown and told his congregation that there's a time to fight and there's a time to pray, and the time to fight has come. So he yanked off his preaching gown and appeared there before his congregation in the uniform of a colonel in the colonial army, and then recruited almost 300 young men from his congregation and marched them off to war.
Right there on the spot.
Mm-hmm. He ended as a brigadier general in the colonial army, saw action all the way down the east coast up to Charleston, South Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
He also was elected to Congress later on, And interestingly enough, the state of Virginia placed his statue as one of their favorite sons in the Hall of Fame in the Rotunda, the federal building in Washington, D.C.
Yeah, that's interesting.
So that's one of the few Lutheran clergymen who stand there in marble today.
Mm-hmm.
His brother, too, was placed in the same Hall of Fame by the state of Pennsylvania as their favorite son. Frederick Augustus Muhlenberg was a pastor in New York. And when the British occupied New York, he fled and came back to Pennsylvania and stayed with his father in Philadelphia for a while, and then participated in the war effort. And he served as a member of Congress and served as the first speaker and the third speaker of Congress.
Mm-hmm.
His statue is also in the Hall of Fame.
Are there any other Lutherans besides the Muhlenbergs that we know of that had any involvement with the Revolution?
My guess is that there were about 75,000 Lutherans in colonial America at the time.
Right.
Yeah, which is a very large number. And they were scattered from New York down into Georgia, the southern Georgia near Savannah.
Mm-hmm.
The Salzburgers arrived there in the 1730s. There were at least one Lutheran chaplain who served the Continental Forces, and that was Christian Streit. He saw action down the East Coast also. Then there's a controversial person. In fact, there were many other Lutherans who participated, but I think our time won't allow that. The Surgeon General of Washington's Army was a Lutheran. And other prominent individuals served who held membership in the Lutheran Church.
Mm-hmm.
But one person whose photo appeared on a postcard issued by the Postal Service some time ago was John Hanson. He was the first president of the United States in Congress assembled before the Constitution was adopted. And the record suggests that he was a Lutheran.
Mm-hmm.
Lutherans were involved in the government of the colonies and also later. John Adam Treutlein, the first governor of Georgia, was also a Lutheran.
Mm-hmm. Is there any way of ascertaining how the Lutherans generally felt about the war? I suppose not, except for these instances that you shared with us.
Yeah, I think it'd be pretty hard to determine how the rank and file of the people felt. And I think somebody has said that the colonies themselves had to engage first in a civil war before they could engage in the Revolutionary War. And I think that's pretty true of the Lutherans, too. They had to find out where they themselves stood first before they could become participants in the effort to work for independence of our country.
Uh-huh. Well, I see that our time is elapsing rather quickly. Do you have a final thought, perhaps, on the meaning of our religious liberty that we do enjoy?
I might mention just very briefly that the religious liberty and freedom that we have did not come automatically. It took an effort, and took an effort on the part of many individuals. And among these individuals, very prominently, were also the Lutherans.
Mm-hmm. I see. Well, thank you so very much. You have just heard Dr. August Soflow of the Concordia Historical Institute share some glimpses with us from the past, and particularly from the Revolutionary War and the Declaration of Independence. Thank you so much.